Well, all right. Happy Easter, everybody. I wish I could say it's good to see your faces, but I'm looking at a camera. I can't see your faces, but I trust that you're there. I've been following along on YouTube and Facebook as you guys have been joining. I hope the first parts of your house churches this morning have been good. Yeah, I was just thinking about this morning, you know, it's Easter Sunday, and oftentimes for Easter, you know, we all dress up in our nice, you know, flowery short sleeve shirts, and we wait for sunshine and it's springtime. But I woke up to a blanket of snow this morning, so all of you in Fort Collins, you know what I'm talking about. Those of you that are elsewhere, I think there's some people joining from Arizona, you probably don't even know what snow is. But, you know, here around here, we don't dream of a white Easter. Contrary to popular opinion, we want a green Easter. And there are leaves coming out on my trees, and I love that. But today we have, well, I'm dreaming of a white Easter. I've known white Easters before. My birthday was yesterday, and I always associate my birthday with Easter. And sometimes you can go outside, and we're going to do an Easter egg hunt later. And I try to convince the kids that, you know, Easter egg hunts in the snow are actually really, really fun. But anyway, we're here because of one thing, and it's the very center of everything that we care about as Christians. It's the very center of it. Jesus Christ, he went into the grave, he was crucified on the cross, he died. People saw him die, and then on Easter Sunday, he rose from the dead and defeated death. Now here, in the midst of this season, Easter is going to look a little bit different. Normally, I'm on stage in front of a bunch of people in a room, and we're all present together. So today, we're thinking virtually, we are present. But for the reality for all of us is the days are all running together. I came up on Friday this week and totally thought it was Saturday for some reason. I don't know. But I've been thinking about that, and in light of that, until further notice, the days of the week are now called this day, that day, other day, someday, yesterday, today, and next day. And so today is sometimes known as Easter, and I guess we'll call it Easter. I think it's Sunday. I think we're on the right day, but that can get kind of confusing. So anyway, we're concluding our series today, and our series is called Death and Delight. We actually had planned this series before all of this virus stuff hit, and we stuck with the series because we realized this actually fits really, really well with this thing that's affecting all of us, and we've been teaching through the last week of the life of Jesus, and it culminates today in his resurrection, like I said. And what the premise of this series has been is that Christianity is uniquely full of joy and delight, and yet its central icon, the thing that we gravitate to, it's the cross, and it represents pain and death and suffering. And so death and delight come together. Our series right before this was in the book of Hebrews, and there's a verse in there that says that for the joy that was set before him, Jesus went to the cross. He endured the pain, the death, because there was a joy out in front of him. And so I just want to start off by saying, you know, if Jesus was like the founders of other religions, he would have stayed dead. He would have stayed dead. He would have given us a blueprint for how we're supposed to live our life and a good philosophy, and then he would have left, and we would have had that blueprint to go, okay, this is how I'm supposed to follow. But because Jesus didn't stay dead, it changes everything. If you believe that Jesus rose from the dead, you don't get a blueprint or a way of life. You get Jesus. You get him because he's alive. It changes everything about how we live our lives today. There's significant implications for what it means for us. I want to talk about those implications today, but why don't you pray with me to start with? Heavenly Father, we're so grateful that you sent Jesus. We talked so much about what Jesus did on that cross in our Good Friday service. Jesus, you took the bullseye of the wrath of God, the justice that needed to be done because there's so much evil in this world. And Jesus, you took it on yourself on that cross. And you took it all the way into the grave. And today we celebrate that you didn't stay dead. You came back to life. You're resurrected. I pray, God, that that would be imprinted on our hearts. We pray for your spirit as you inhabit each one of us. You're everywhere at once. And so you're in every single one of our living rooms. And so we're gathered. We are your church gathered, even though we're dispersed this morning. We trust that you have something for each one of us. I pray you'd soften us. You'd soften me as well to listen and respond as your Spirit prompts this morning. And we trust that you're going to do a good work and that you're going to change us. Thank you for today and thank you for gathering your people together. I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. Let me ask this. Have you ever had a near-death experience? Have you ever had one of those moments where something real fast happened, the adrenaline hit, and you saw your life flash before your eyes? I have. I've actually had several of them. But one in particular, let me just go back just a little bit, because you have to start this story a few months back. Because I was living in the dorms back in the late 90s at Colorado State University. I came out one day, and someone had gone on a vandalism spree, and they had bashed in the back window. I was driving an 83 GMC Jimmy, like a full-size Blazer from the 80s, right? So this is the late 90s, so it's a little bit of an older truck. So I wasn't too concerned about driving around without a back window. So I got and went over to a gas station. I got the vacuum out, and I cleaned up all the glass. And then I got a bid, and I realized I didn't have the money to pay for a new window. This is one of those windows, that the big windows, you know, that slides up and down in the tailgate and the Blazer. And so I drove around for a little bit without a back window. And, you know, the exhaust would kind of come in. And there was one day, I don't know, Lee Vary, if you're watching, if you're probably watching, you were watching on Friday. Lee and I and our friend Josh, we decided to go to a punk show in Denver. And so we had to drive all the way down I-25 and all the way back. And it was fine going down because it was sunny and it was warm. And the show was great. And we were exhausted and sunburned. We piled back in and Lee was in the back seat and Josh was in the passenger seat. And we started driving back up and I was like, oh my goodness, there's some clouds coming. It hadn't rained yet at this point. So I wasn't quite sure what was going to happen. So we're driving up I-25 at 75 miles an hour. And I look in the back and Lee's just zonked out. Like he's drooling out the side of his mouth and sunburned and hot. And I'm kind of glad the back window's open because it's kind of cool. But all of a sudden it just, I mean, this downpour happens. And the water starts coming in and he's still sleeping back there, but I can tell he's getting wet because I can see the mist is actually on the inside of the windshield in front of me. It's getting a little bit hard to see. So I'm wiping out, got a t-shirt and I'm wiping the window and eventually it stops raining and Lee wakes up and he's all soaking wet and he's probably laughing in his living room right now listening to this. This is a great memory. And the inside of the car is wet. And so, you know, I was like, all right, this is fine. I'm a dumb college student, you know, with the carpet back there, it's dirty anyway, it's old. And I didn't have the money to fix it, so I didn't really worry about it. So flash forward a few months to this near-death experience. We decided we wanted to go skiing, and they called my truck the Ski-Mobile. I called it a truck. It was basically a Blazer. I had good tires on it and stuff. But I didn't have a back window, so me being the really bright college student that I was, I went to Walmart, and I got some clear plastics. I thought, you know, clear plastic, you can see through that, and some duct tape. And so Josh and I, we got in the back and we just duct taped that clear plastic, stretch it really tight across the back so it wouldn't, you know, wave in the wind and stuff like that. And we put our skis in and we started driving. We're like, I think this will work. I mean, I've got the side mirrors. I can't see through the rear view mirror. I found out the clear plastic really isn't all that clear. But I can see out the front. I can see the sides. And Josh can lean out the window, you know, to check the blind spot if I really need something. And so it was fine. And we're driving up I-70. Until we get to Vail Pass. And it had been sunny, it had been fine, it was cold out, but it was okay. We had the heat blasting, you know, it was all right. And then all of a sudden we realized, oh, it's been snowing up here for a while. And you know, in Colorado, they don't put salt on the roads, they put sand on the roads, and the sand is kind of mixed with the snow, and it's kind of this soupy mud, right? And there's ice underneath that, and so the road's getting a little hairy, and we come up to Vail Pass. And if you've ever driven Vail Pass, you know the other side of Vail Pass gets real steep and it's kind of scary. And there's semi-trucks coming by. And I start realizing not only can I not see out the back, but these semi-trucks are coming up alongside me and they're spraying the side windows. And now I had blind spots before, but I've really got blind spots. But I'm okay because I got windshield wipers, you know, and so there's some slush and stuff hitting the front window. And we're just going along and Josh is kind of like, are we going to die? Like, I can't see anymore. This is not good. And suddenly I realize I just ran through all of the windshield washer fluid. And we're going down Vail Pass and there's trucks and there's ice and there's slush. And all of a sudden this big truck goes by And you know those moments where it just washes like the entire contents of the road across your windshield? It did that. Just... I couldn't see a thing. And the windshield wipers are going and I still can't see a thing because it's just smudging the mud. And I can't see out the back because there's plastic and it's covered with mud anyway. I can't see out the side windows and I'm on the highway. And my life flashed in front of my eyes. I thought I was going to die. And Josh's like, you have to pull over now. So I slam on the brakes. I don't know who was behind me. I was so grateful that they didn't run into the back of me. Slammed on the brakes and just gingerly pulled off the side of the road. I'm just so grateful to be alive. Got out of the car and we got into a snowbank and we scrubbed the windows with all this snow, trying to be able to get to the point where we could see again. And we had to do that multiple times as we were driving down. Eventually we got to a gas station and I got some windshield washer fluid. So right now you're thinking, wow, this guy's really not very smart. That's okay. But have you ever had that moment where you're like, I might die right now? And you see bits and pieces of your life. And maybe you realize, like I realized, there's some things I regret. And if I die right now, I'm going to come in front of a God of justice. And there's a few things I'm not sure that he's going to be okay with. And I don't have the chance right now to fix that. And that's kind of the moment that I had as my heart's pumping. And so, if you have your Bibles, we're going to turn to Matthew 28. We're actually going to read the first 10 verses of Matthew 28. I'll put them up on the slides as well. But this is one of the accounts in the four Gospels. There's four different accounts of Jesus' resurrection. This is one of my favorites in the book of Matthew. And so we're going to start there in the first 10 verses, just give you guys a chance to get there. Jesus didn't just have a near-death moment, he had a full-death moment. And then this is what happens. So the context up to this point is Jesus has died, they've laid him in a tomb, they've rolled a stone over the tomb. The stone is so large, it would take multiple people to push this tomb away. You cannot push this stone out from the inside. It's impossible. And they've posted guards outside the tomb to keep his followers, to keep Jesus' followers from coming and stealing the body. And so here's what happens. Matthew 28, verse 1. Now after the Sabbath, toward the dawn of the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary went to see the tomb. And behold, there was a great earthquake, for an angel of the Lord descended from heaven and came and rolled back the stone and sat on it. That's such a great move. I mean, he just comes and he rolls away and then he just like sits on it. Like, no big deal. Bam. Stone's been rolled away. I'm just going to sit here. Take that. Like, that's awesome. All right. So our next verse. His appearance was like lightning and his clothing white as snow. And for fear of him, the guards trembled and became like dead men. But the angel said to the women, don't be afraid, for I know that you seek Jesus who is crucified. He's not here, for he is risen as he said. It's like, duh, he said it. He said he would rise. So why are you surprised? He's not here. He has risen. He said it. I love that. Come see the place where he lay. Prove it to yourself. You're skeptical? Come and look. Then go quickly and tell his disciples that he's risen from the dead. And behold, he's going before you to Galilee. There you will see him. See, I have told you. So they departed quickly from the tomb with fear and great joy, and ran to tell his disciples. Next verse. And behold, Jesus met them and said, greetings. And they came up and took hold of his feet and worshiped him. And Jesus said to them, don't be afraid. Go and tell my brothers to go to Galilee, and there they will see me. So Jesus appeared to them. And that's an interesting phrase, where they were filled with fear and great joy. Why were they filled with fear? You know, there's a reality there that they knew something that every single one of us knows. People don't rise from the dead. I think there's a modern misconception that somehow people 2,000 years ago were more receptive to the belief that people rose from the dead. And the reality is they really weren't. If you look at the Greco-Roman culture of the time, they actually had this really solid belief that the physical, the body, it wouldn't rise at all. That was where their philosophy had led them. They said, you know, there's actually a separation between the good in life, and that's what the spiritual is. It's a disembodied good, though. It's not connected to this body because that's where all the carnal things are. That's where the biology is. That's where you have dirty things like eating and drinking and defecating and sex and all that. That's just polluted. And so they said, you know, if anything happens after death, it's going to be a spiritual existence that wouldn't be a bodily resurrection. And even the Jews at the time that were in that area, you know, they were devout believers, but they didn't believe in a bodily resurrection. Some of them didn't believe in it at all. For others, this is something that might happen way later at the very, very end of time, but it's certainly not going to happen in the middle of history. And so the people at the time, they weren't predisposed to think, oh, this is a possibility. And so they looked into the tomb and they were filled with fear because they realized, I think it's true. And so simultaneously, they're terrified because people don't just rise from the dead. And at the same time, they're filled with great joy and hope. Jesus had resurrected from the dead. They realized that it had happened, that it was a fact. And so that's what I want to talk about this morning, is the joy that comes from that understanding. And maybe it's better framed in this season of coronavirus with the word hope. And I'm not talking about like the way we normally mean hope, like a secular hope. I want to talk about the way the Bible talks about hope. And start us off with this account, you know, here in Matthew, where we talk about the fact that he resurrected and their reaction to it. And then I also want to go into a little bit in the New Testament and in the writings of Paul, particularly in 1 Corinthians 15, because he talks a lot about the resurrection and then the implications that are associated with the resurrection if it actually happened. And so, first of all, there's this verse that he wrote in 1 Corinthians 15, verse 19, where he says, if in Christ we have hope, remember we're talking about hope, if we have hope in this life only, we are of all people most to be pitied. And so let's talk about that hope for a minute. As Christians, we have a hope that goes beyond this life. We have, you know, hope in English is actually kind of a weak word. Like you say, I hope so, and you really mean, I'm not sure if this is going to happen, but man, I hope so. But in the Bible, hope is this joyful conviction that's based on compelling evidence, and that is Christian hope. And so when we talk about joy being able to coexist with fear and with death, we're talking about this joy that comes from this hope, and it's a hope that enables a person to face any trial that comes our way. And so Christians historically, you know, have been resilient. I've referenced this book in past sermons actually for several years, this book and another one that Rodney Stark wrote. This book was called The Rise of Christianity. He later wrote another one called The Triumph of Christianity. He's a secular historian. And if you're looking for evidences and just realities of what Christians were like back in the first and second century, these are great books to start with. And he talks about basically why the church rose to such popularity in that Roman Empire. And he mentioned three specific things in this book. The first one, he mentioned that there were really great epidemics, like illnesses, plagues, that would hit the urban centers in the Greco-Roman world. And there was a reality that while everybody else fled away and just let relatives and friends and neighbors die of these sicknesses, the Christians, the early Christians, took care of the sick, even though many of them also got sick and they died. It was like they weren't afraid of death. And then the second thing he mentions, he says, when they were persecuted, meaning when they were unjustly imprisoned and they were unjustly put to death by the authorities of the time, they didn't really resist. They didn't retaliate with violence. They didn't move and resort to guerrilla warfare. They were different. They were different. They would go into the arena, sometimes even singing and rejoicing when the lions were eating them. And then the third thing is really that he highlights in this book. He says that at this time, it's the height of that Roman Empire, and Rome had basically conquered the whole world and done away with borders. And so you had all these cities that Christians were in, that churches were in, and these cities, for the first time in the history of the world, were multi-ethnic. And so all these people had come from all over the place, and they were just for the first time having to interact with one another, and there was all this racial violence and tension, and the church was the first institution in the history of the world that brought people together across those ethnic barriers. No institution had ever done that before. And so we have to ask that question of why. Why in the first century were Christians so compassionate to the sick? Why were they forgiving of their persecutors? Why were they asking for forgiveness for their persecutors when they were being put to death? Why were they ethnically so inclusive? Because it depended on what they believed their future was. Their pagan neighbors, they didn't see past death. They couldn't see it. It was like a darkness. It was like it was shrouded in mystery. They didn't know what death had in store, but Christians had hope. They had this joyous vision of what Christ had given them in the resurrection, this eternal vision of glory and love. And so they stayed in the cities even though the plague was killing them because they didn't fear death, because they knew after they die, they get to be loved by God in person. They didn't retaliate when they got persecuted because at the end of the time, they knew the day of judgment was coming and the perfect judge of the universe was going to set everything right. They knew that that was going to happen, so they didn't have to be the judge at that time, so they could just pray and sing and rejoice. And while all of the individual pagan societies and different ethnic groups had their own religions and their own gods, Christians believed there was one God that stood over all of the nations, and that God was going to create this new tribe that contained every tongue, every tribe, every people, every race, every nation, and they were equal. And so they had this completely distinct conviction that gave them hope about their future. And so they lived their life differently than everybody else around them. And the thing that marked their difference is that they were absolutely certain about their future. They knew for certain because they had seen with their own eyes that Jesus had died. And now they saw with their own eyes that he had risen from the dead. And so they had hope because they had compelling evidence. And that hope brought them joy. They saw that Jesus had conquered death, and so they're thrown into the lions and they could sing. And so I'm not talking about optimism when I mention hope. Really, I'm talking more about realism. Because I think a lot of times in life, we want to respond optimistically, and so we kind of go about ignoring the fact that life actually really kind of stinks. But I think Christian hope enables Christians to be joyfully realistic about life. Life is really hard, and it stinks. Stop trying to deny it. You know, this lockdown is actually really hard. We're under stay-at-home orders. The whole globe has shut down. There's a lot of fear. There's a lot of financial tension. There's a lot of, man, we are actually giving away food at the church to people who are driving up in cars afraid of getting a virus, first of all, so they have to keep their distance. And so we're socially and relationally isolated, and we're experiencing all this stuff, and people don't have supplies and don't know where rent is coming from. And it's a challenging time. And you can be optimistic and just sort of ignore it and gloss over it and have the rose-colored glasses, and I don't think that's what I'm talking about. There could be a joy that comes from that, but it's an unintellectual joy. It's an unrealistic joy. And I'm talking about a different kind of joy that sees life for what it truly is in this moment and still has hope and joy. Because a Christian can look at the pain of life, or even sometimes the fact that all the days are blurring together and it's just mundane and kind of boring, and can look at this life and go, you know what? There's a few shadows now, but I'm headed towards a bright, eternal future, and so I can deal with a little bit of life stinking right now. It always bugs me. I was talking with my wife. She's sitting right over here, and my kids are right over here. We're in our living room. We're doing church in our living room. I was talking with her just the other day, and we're talking about why is it that we don't really feel anxious in this season? You know, I'm not really concerned about getting this virus. I'm trying to figure out why that is. Am I just like pathologically ignoring the realities of life somehow? And I don't think that's the case. I don't think that is. And it actually kind of surprises me sometimes when people get shocked at how life is hard. Like somehow you've lived in denial up to this point, or maybe you're just young enough that you haven't experienced pain. You haven't had those moments where death flashes before your eyes. And somehow it's like we don't expect life to be tough. But I feel like when I look at life, I expect it to be really hard. I'm expecting it to be hard. And as I get older, I'm in my 40s and my body starts falling apart and pains are happening. It's going to be hard, and we shouldn't be shocked when life is hard, when we lose our jobs, when someone passes away around us, when we get sick and we don't recover. And, you know, it shouldn't shock us. And if it does, I'm afraid we're living in a weird optimistic world of denial and not in realism and Christian hope. And so I want to turn us for the rest of this morning to 1 Corinthians 15 and the last part of it. I'm going to go all the way up to verse 53. So the context, before we read this particular piece, the context is Paul has spent this whole chapter talking about the compelling evidence that Christ was actually raised from the dead. He mentions that there's 500 eyewitnesses. He mentions many of those witnesses. He even mentions some of them by name. He mentions that some of them are still living. And so he writes this very public document to people who actually knew that they could go back and ask some of these eyewitnesses. He's basically saying, hey, if you want to check this out to see if this is actually true, there's compelling evidence because 500 plus people saw him alive. And if you're curious, just go ask them. You couldn't make that claim unless it was true. I actually saw him. You could go to the person who saw him, touched him, talked to him. That's how Christianity started. That's how it rose to this great institution that it is. I know it sounds nuts. If you don't believe in life after death, it doesn't make any sense. And these people were in the exact same space that you are in your mind as well. It doesn't make sense, but I saw him. And I talked to him. He was there. And if you want to know, go ask. Because we saw it. That's what he's talking about in this chapter. He talks about the compelling evidence and the hope that we have now that Jesus has actually destroyed our enemy, and that enemy is death. And he says we're going to be changed in the twinkling of an eye. We're going to be raised with Christ to immortality. And so, let me get to this verse. He says this. 1 Corinthians 15, 53 to 55, for this perishable body must put on the imperishable, this mortal body must put on immortality. When the perishable puts on the imperishable and the mortal puts on immortality, then shall come to pass the saying that is written, death is swallowed up in victory. O death, where is your sting? O death, where is your victory? And so for the rest of our time here, I want to talk about two things. I want to talk about the defeat of death and the hope of the resurrection. And so let's talk about the defeat of death, because I think we have to see it differently than the world sees it. We have to see it as a defeated enemy. Most people don't look at it this way, but when the perishable puts on the imperishable, death is swallowed up in victory, Paul is saying here. And so we have to ask, why is it being swallowed up in victory? Because the premise that he has there is that death is an enemy. I was listening to a podcast the other day. I went back trying to find it. I thought it was a TED Talk, but I wasn't able to find it. But I listened to this podcast while I was working on some woodworking stuff. Because, you know, we're all doing home projects now that we're all cooped up. So I was out with the saw and my headphones. And I saw the title. And the title was, it was a psychologist, a secular psychologist. And she was advising people on how to think and how to feel and how to process in this season of COVID-19. And she had some advice on dealing with death. It was interesting. It was fascinating, actually. She talked about this reality, and I think it's a true reality in our world, is that our modern people spend most of our time denying the reality of death. And that's actually a mistake. And I agreed with her on that point. Like, we hide it. We make it this clinical thing. We don't end up facing the thing that is inevitable, that every single one of us is going to face. But, you know, she mentioned, you know, 100, 150 years ago, You know, if grandma passed away, odds are she did it in your bed or in her bed, in her bedroom, in your house with your family there. And you'd go and you'd lay her out and friends and family would come over and pay their last respects. And then dad and the kids would go in the backyard and dig a grave. And they would have to actually touch the body and put her in the grave and put dirt on her. And today, if a kid saw something like that, they'd need therapy. That's how the world lives. Today, we don't do that. And that was kind of her point in this podcast. Today, we're scared of death. We don't face it. The only place we see it is in the movies. We never actually come in contact with it. We hide it away behind medical terminals and we sedate people so they're not even aware that they're dying. We're horrified by it. We're creeped out by it. We're more scared of death than any other generation in the history of the world. And I think one of the reasons for it is because our modern culture dismisses the supernatural. Remember how I started out telling the story of my near-death experience where I'm driving down the highway in a car that I can't see out of? What did I have to do? I had to stop. Because you need to see outside the car in order to operate it. And without the supernatural, you can't see God in eternity, his righteousness, his justice. You can't see that, and you can't see how to operate life. You can't see true reality, just like I couldn't see the reality that was outside. I didn't know if I was about to get head-on in a collision with a semi-truck or a tree or a guardrail or slide. I didn't know. And so I had to take my foot off the gas. You can't see reality when you can't see eternity. You're driving blind. Normal Christian virtues don't make any sense when you can't see eternity. Things like making sacrifices, living for principles and morals and ideals faithfully. You can't see a sense of the future reality of the world, eternity. You can't see how your choices affect that future. And so when my windshield got blacked out by mud, I felt anxious and just, all I wanted was to be able to see. And my only choice was to stop driving. And that's why death, I think, is so scary for modern culture. We don't know what's coming. We don't know what's going to happen. We don't know what we're doing inside here. We don't know how to operate. And it feels like just this anxiety welling up. And so I listened to this podcast a couple weeks ago. She's talking about how you could train yourself to die without fear if you were able to put your mind in a place where you realized you were just going to cease to exist. You're just going to be annihilated. You're no longer conscious. And so why should you fear something if you're not conscious of it happening? What's there to be afraid of? And I didn't agree with her on that point because, first of all, there's a logical flaw in her argument because she can't possibly know that that's where humans are destined to go. There's a Greek philosopher back in the day called Epicurus. And he was fascinated with this idea, and he was trying to push this, that you're annihilated after you die. And he said this, he said, what people fear most about death is not that maybe death is annihilation, but maybe that it's not. And so here's the problem with all of us. We've all failed. We failed. We start off early on failing our parents. And we fail our siblings. We fail our spouses. We don't do a good job in our careers. We cheat and we lie and we steal. And every single one of us can look back on our past and go, I know I said I never wanted to do that. But somehow I got myself in that situation. I did that. And boy, do I regret it. And so when we think about death, it scares us. Because there's a problem. On one hand, if there's no judge at the end of our life, if there's no judge that's going to make everything right, you know, we look around us and we see things like animal abuse and child abuse, and we see these nasty, horrific evils. And if there's no judge for any of it at the end of life, man, there's a hopelessness that comes with that. But there's a reality that if there is a judge, every single one of us in the back of our mind or maybe in the front of our mind or in the pit of our stomach realizes payment's going to come due for me. that day that I die. And we're afraid of death because maybe it's not annihilation. We're driving without windows. And we hate it. And if you live with that philosophy, you're not being rational if you say that I can embrace death. You're simply not. You're living in denial. And so we as a modern culture put our dead away. But seasons like COVID-19 season, suddenly we've had to have psychologists coming and advising us on how to think because we're seeing it. We're starting to experience it. We're starting to witness it. And so the conclusion that this woman in this podcast came to, she said, well, basically there is no supernatural, and so you shouldn't fear death. That's going to be psychologically devastating for you because you can't deny the thing that you fear. You have to face it. You have to somehow come to grips with it. Otherwise, it's going to dominate your life. And so she said, in her secular viewpoint, you have to not think of it like those who have religious value judgments. You just have to think about it as a natural part of life. You slip into unconsciousness like it's nothing to be feared. And it's a dreamless sleep that's your friend. The problem with her logic there is that that in of itself is basically a religious, maybe a non-religious, but it's a value statement. And beyond that, it's a huge assumption. The joy that Paul talks about here in this passage, it depends on death, first of all, not being ignored or denied or put away. And second, it depends on death not being your friend. Because death is an enemy. It's not natural. You know this. You can feel it deep down in your bones. You've lost sleep over this in your life. I know it because I have. Human beings aren't meant to just stop existing. We want to last. We want to keep going. We want the things that we apply ourselves to and the creativity and all of the stuff. We want it to continue. And we realize that death is not natural. It's actually one of the most unnatural things that is out there. Bothers us, and it's the ultimate, most powerful enemy that we have, and it gets every single one of us in the end. But Paul has the audacity in this passage to say, where, O death, is your victory? Look at this. Where, O death, is your sting? You know, that's a pretty formal translation. I really think if you want to say this in modern English, this is kind of how he's saying it. Hey, death. Na 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 na, you can't get me. He's showing death no respect at all. He's teasing death. It has no sting. And Paul can laugh, and you can laugh because of the gospel. Jesus died for our sins. And then he rose and defeated death. It's irrational not to fear death unless you know this. The payment due notice that you're afraid is going to come to you when you die for all of your wrongdoing has been paid in full. Jesus paid it. He fulfilled it. He took your wrongdoing. He took your flaws. He took the things that you know that you owe, and he dealt with it. Death was coming for you like a bullet, and Jesus threw himself in front of it. And it took him right in the chest. Where, O death, is your sting? Don't be afraid. It's been defeated. You can laugh in its face. You can taunt it. Death, do your worst. When I die, when death, you take me, when you feel like you've won death, I'm only going to resurrect just like Jesus did. And that's the last point that I want to end on today. We talked about death being defeated. I want to talk about the resurrection, because there's a reality that we're going to be resurrected with Jesus. We're actually going to get new bodies. Remember, I talked about the Greco-Roman world and how they had this view that the physical, the body, the material, it was somehow bad, and the spiritual is going to be separated from that. Salvation to them meant you get rid of the physical, that dirty, limiting thing, and you just embrace the spiritual, like sort of this, you know, Nirvana thing where everybody sort of is swimming around in the same sort of pool of spiritual flotation, nothingness, and feeling each other's vibrations. And so, you know, it's just this weird sort of ethereal thing. But God invented physical. He invented physical and he invented spirit, and he did it together, and they've both been crushed under sin, and they both need to be redeemed. And so you were invented as an individual with a body and with a soul, and they're put together, and you're going to be redeemed and resurrected as a body and a soul. And so your soul might be full of fear today. And your body's falling apart. I mean, as I get older, I recognize that. I've got 5 senses. And this one, my eyes, right? My eyes. It's starting to feel like I have 4.5 senses. Because they're just getting worse. And they're going to continue to get worse. And from what I hear, from what I understand, and from what I'm starting to experience, we start deteriorating. And this body does become this just burden on each one of us. But It's hard to really get this. The gospel is such good news. It doesn't just address that forgiveness need, the need for that punishment, you know, to be taken away from us. That's a massive part of the gospel. But when Jesus resurrected from the dead and defeated death itself, he did something else for us. And it's the second part of the gospel. It's what we've been saved from that past. We're saved into something. It's a resurrection. And it's physical, and it's the soul. It addresses every single part of reality, even addresses the material world around us, that the whole earth is even going to be remade and renewed and resurrected and restored. It's going to purge everything that's bad and bring in everything that's good, and it's going to be glorious. And I really think, I mean, based on the biblical descriptions and the realities, I mean, I talked about, you know, maybe I'm turning into having 4.5 senses. Maybe later on in my life, it'll be like I only have 3 senses. Explain to someone who's blind. I'm trying to think about the best way to describe eternity. Trying to explain to someone who's been born blind. I was talking with my dad yesterday, and he texted me this analogy, so I figured I'd use it. Someone who was born blind. Try to explain the color red to them. Well, it kind of sounds like an electric guitar. They know what the electric guitar sounds like. No, you just can't. Unless you experience it, you can't explain it. We're going to be resurrected. We're going to be glorified. And I wonder when that happens, how many senses we're going to have. Maybe we're going to have 100 senses, completely different than sight and taste and hearing and smell. We're going to be experiencing such incredibly new things. I think we may be even capable of some infinite growth of sensation. I don't know. It's going to be absolutely amazing. I think the form that we take then, when we're finally glorified and resurrected, if we could catch a glimpse of that now, I think we'd be tempted to worship ourselves. To be perfectly honest, Christianity is the only religion that talks about a future glory. The physical, the individual, the restoration. We're not going to be disembodied spirits floating around. You're going to be you, just the best version of you. I mean, it's super concrete. You're going to eat. After Jesus resurrected, he ate fish. You're going to eat. You're going to love it. You're going to drink. You're going to walk around on redeemed feet. You're not going to worry about catching a virus. We're going to get to hug people again. I think about this. You're going to know your friends there, the friends that you have now and the things that you've done together. You're going to know those things. And I'm going to walk up. I'm probably going to run up to my friend Paul Van Ryn. I'm like, man, look at you. Look at what Jesus made you into. Whoa. Like, I saw glimpses of this back, you know, in our former life, like in your very best moments. But this, like, we're going to sing. I mean, music. I love music. It moves me to the depths of my core. We're going to sing like we've never sung before. It's going to be so beautiful. I'm finally going to get that perfect guitar tone that I've been searching for my whole life and spent thousands of dollars finding. I'm going to get it. We're going to dance. We're going to learn. We're going to build things. We're going to create things. And so I look at the shadows of what we're facing right now, the difficulties that we're facing right now. And it brings to mind another thing that Paul wrote. He wrote in Romans 8, verse 18, where he says, I consider that our present sufferings are not worth comparing with the glory that will be revealed in us. So we titled this series, Death and Delight. And early on, as soon as COVID-19 hit, someone suggested to me that maybe having the word death in our title was inappropriate and insensitive to what was actually going to start happening around us in the season. And I disagree. Because I don't want us to ignore death. I'd rather have us think clearly about it. Because it highlights what Christ has done. He came into earth in a physical body so that he could die. And now he's seated at the right hand of God. And he's guaranteed that I get to rule and reign with him one day in glory forever. And so I want to think about death and its reality and the sadness and its power over us and everything that it is and brings. I want to think in clarity about it, because when I see it for what it really is, I see the implications for human beings. And then I turn and I look at my Savior and I see how he swallowed up death in victory. The glory of that victory becomes even greater. The magnificence and the glory of Jesus Christ. So I just say at this point, bring it on, grave. Bring it on, death. Hurt me. Kill me. I'm not afraid, because my hope is not in this world. I can see outside the car. I've got real hope. My real health is waiting for me on the other end of death. My real wealth and accomplishment is waiting for me there. My glory, my affirmation, my joy, everything is waiting for me there. And death, you can only bring me closer to it. So bring it on. Think about it with clarity and reality. Don't ignore it. And maybe you're sitting there thinking, I don't know, there's a lot of people watching this right now. And maybe you're thinking, I just don't believe this. And I just plead with you to think. Why is it that you went on that diet? You want a new body. Women, why do you put on makeup? You want new skin. For me, I'm losing my hair. Why does that bother me? Because I want my hair! I'm gonna get it back someday. Why are we always buying things? Why do we have this materialism? Why do we have this desire for new stuff all the time? We look deep down in us, and I just challenge you to do that right now. It's a hunger for God. It's a hunger for eternity. You know that everything is decaying, but you know deep down in your bones that that's not how it's meant to be. And you're craving the new. You're made for a place where everything is getting newer and better all the time, where food doesn't rot, it just keeps getting fresher. And thanks to Jesus, there's a place where that is really going to happen. And it's so much more vivid and real than this life. And one day we're going to be there, and your sorrow will turn to joy. Death will turn to delight. No one will ever be able to take the hope and joy away from you. Delight in that. Hope in that. It'll change your heart. It'll soften your heart. It'll change your outlook. You'll be able to drive the car of this life with the pedal to the metal because you can see with clarity outside all the windows. You're going to run to the city where the plague is, even though it might kill you. You're going to face persecution and be thrown to the lions with a song. You're going to embrace and include those who have been excluded, the outsiders, the people who are not like you, and you're going to laugh in the face of death. Because Jesus rose from the dead. He is risen. And all of you in your living room should respond. It's a fact. He's risen indeed. So let's do it. He is risen. He's risen indeed. Let me pray and we'll be done. God, I thank you for the clarity. I thank you for the evidence. I thank you that there's so much more evidence than even what I talked about today. We can know that Jesus really overcame death. And we can look death in the face and not see it as something that's going to conquer us. It's an enemy, but it's been defeated. Help us to know that deep down in our bones. We are destined for another place, and the perishable will put on the imperishable. And it's going to be glorious. It's going to be amazing. And Jesus, you did it for us. We praise you together as your church this morning. Amen.